Okay, everybody, welcome back. Would you please join me in the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Okay, out of respect for our speaker, please turn off your cell phones or silence them. Right? And our speaker is being recorded with her permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren, who's not there anymore. And I would like to introduce this evening's speaker. We have B from San Clemente. Let's give her a warm welcome, you guys.
Hi, everybody. I'm B, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
You know, I sent for the longest time, and like for a few days, and I've been up here many times before, but I know that when you go over in your head what you want to say, you never say it. So I have been just keeping my blank, keep it blank, keep it blank, and now my mind is blank. So, yeah, how did that work for me? All I know is my sponsor has always told me, when you stand and tell the truth, you want everybody to know what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'm going to do my best to just, you know, tell you along those lines. I didn't start my drinking career until, you know, like late. I was 20 years old. And I was the youngest kid of eight, the baby girl, and raised mostly by my mom because my dad was a stone drunk. I mean, big time alcoholic, to the point where he got so drunk in Philly that the law was tired of arresting him. So they banned him from the city. And he had to go live somewhere else. And because it was small time, I'm kind of old. I just don't like lick it. But back in the day, you know, it's like you knew the judges and so forth. It was, although it was a big city, it was still more small town. And they were very familiar, you know, the judges, with my mom trying to raise eight kids by herself. And she had, like, a lot of compassion. What was the guy? Had a lot of compassion for the family, because he said, you come here every week when you could be at home with your loving family. And, you know, that statement, like, rang true even later in life when I found out I was an alcoholic. My mom was great. My mom was loving and wonderful, and we were poor as a joke, but she raised us all with a lot of love. And she raised us in church, and we were stair-stepped right, like on the same pew. And I always thought that I was born at church because I never remember, like, starting. I had always been there. And so my brothers and sisters let me think that I was born under one of the pews, you know, and that was for a long time, really. I didn't find out any different until I was about 17, but, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. So, you know, I got into this adult life, like, really quickly. I graduated from high school on June 11th, and June 14th, I got married a few days later, and a few days after that, I had my first daughter. So me and God, we do it in a week, you know, but I just went to this major adult life, like, all of a sudden, and it was a little overwhelming for me, but I had to do the best I could do. I was kind of kept very, let's don't tell her anything, you know, let's don't let her know what life is like, so that I would be ignorant. They thought that it would be bliss for me, but actually it was just the opposite. So anyways, I took my, you know, me and my family, my husband joined the Marine Corps, and that's how we got to come to California. So I am feeling all of a sudden like this adult with freedom, because I was so far from home, 3,000 miles away, and that's when my drinking career started. I thought, like, you know, nobody can see me, nobody knows what's really going on, and, you know, that first drink of booze just really hit home. It was nice. I liked the way I felt. I felt very, very fluid. I felt all my inhibitions had gone, and my clothes too. I just didn't even realize that the first time. But that continuously happened throughout my drinking career. They'd melt away. But, you know, I was stuck. I was stuck in this place where I liked to feel it so much that I would do it, like, every day. And I drank a lot, you guys. I mean, I know it seems like really weird, but I had finished my drinking career like drinking big family size vodkas, you know, like by myself. Sometimes I would have two in a day. And that was like with no mix or anything. And I did, you know, blacked out every day. But at first, when it was like fun, you know, I started off like drinking wine, because I thought, I drank Blue Nun, and I thought it was blessed wine by the gods. I thought it was good. I can drink this and get drunk because I'm not doing anything really bad. But that didn't last too long before I just kept wanting to get in the car and start driving, you know, and I would get in the car every time. I don't know why. It was like that's the one thing I wanted to do. And so it wound up being the end of my marriage because of alcohol. You know, my husband couldn't take it, but actually I couldn't take him when I was drunk. So I moved down to this area, and it's been a long time now, since like the mid-70s that I've been in San Clemente. So I found down here a lot of people that love to do the things that I like to do, drink, you know. And I had a very white issue too, the beautiful white powdery substance that just kind of took me to a whole different plateau as well. And I balanced myself out all day long with one and the other, one and the other. I became so irresponsible that I wound up doing things that I had sworn to myself that I would never do. And it started involving, like, the neglect of my children. And actually, it couldn't possibly start the neglect, because the minute I got drunk and I chose to do that every day, that started the neglect of my children. And I'd had three by then. I really tried to stop getting pregnant, but the laws of nature were not working for me. After my first daughter, I had this IUD put in, and for 2 years, until my husband's like, "What is this?" It's like, "Oh my God." You know, so it was like that one time I was pregnant. And then after my second daughter, I had her, then I had my tubes tied and cauterized, and 6 years later, I'm pregnant again. And I was freaking scared. I mean, just to like look at men after that, it's like, I thought if I was in a room with them, it's like, you know, I didn't know what was going on, but I kept popping out these babies. But, you know, so now I have three, and I'm here with no husband and a boyfriend that's doing the same thing that I'm doing. And it just didn't amount to any good. I had the son that I always wanted, but I didn't have any joy inside myself. I felt like I never got a chance to live because my family sheltered me. And all I wanted to do was just be this irresponsible person now and have fun and get drunk. But, you know, I have to tell you guys and say this, and I really go to the depths of my heart with this, and I don't say it proudly, but my children became kind of a real problem in my life for my drinking. And I had been put out on the street or living in Dana Point at the villa, hotel that used to be there. And my kids would look at me like, "Mom, we're just hungry." And in my heart, I'm telling you, in my heart, I was thinking, if I had money, I wouldn't even feed you with it. I'd rather just get drunk and get loaded and pretend like you don't even exist. And that's what my heart really felt. And I don't like to say that, but I need to tell you that. I need to be honest with you and let you know exactly where alcohol took me. And it was always something, you know, to this day that I can't quite forget, to see three small faces just looking toward Mom, because Mom was everything. So, you know, from that point on, it wasn't enough for me to improve my behavior. I start trying to deal drugs. I ran through the streets of Dana Point all the time with kilos of drugs strapped to me, running from helicopters, going through the street. And I remember I totally went to my girlfriend's house one time because I knew this helicopter was after me. I just knew it. The spotlight was I was real stealthy because I was all skinny, you know, of course I was skinny, but you know, I was all stealthy and I'm running through the streets, and I went and I knocked on my girlfriend's door. And she opened the door, and I've got bushes and crap all over my hair. It was let me in. She goes, "Oh, hell no," you know. And she just, because you could just hear the whirlybird, man, going off. And so I had to, just crawl my way through the streets and just the nastiness of the ground, you know. And it was even raining at night, and it was gross and horrible. And I stopped, and I'm sitting in this bush, peeping out, what am I doing here? How did I get here? I don't remember it being, so awful. I remember that first drink and how good it is, and now I'm in the dirt, you know, with helicopter shiny lights. I had parked my car far away, and I crawled through alleys and driveways and garages until I got to my car, and I got away with that, you know, that time. But, you know, I wasn't always so lucky. And I guess it's fortunate now that it's happened, but, you know, I used to get boyfriends and just take them prisoner, and they would live with me. And when I stopped to think about it, I would look, because I was always kind of like the bitch with the bag. And I wanted to be the boss of everybody. And I would reward you with a little, and I give you all the booze and everything you can handle, but I'm going to be the boss of you. And that's how I was. It was extremely controlling and volatile relationships. And I never had really good control of my bladder. And so every night I went to bed. Every night I peed on somebody, whoever it was in my bed, you know, and it was seriously, I had to, like, actually buy a water bed so I wouldn't ruin my mattress, you know, intentionally, so I just can get away with just, like, losing control all night. And, you know, I don't know how many, you know, controlled men I went through with that action. But, you know, and it was like one, you know, I even had like two boyfriends at the same time living in the same house. And if one was misbehaved, he would be on punishment and he had to go to that room. And I heard him talking one time going, "You can have it, man. She's pissed on me just like enough." I'm just like, heaven. And I'm like, well, you know, I mean, and I had a nerve to be shocked and appalled, you know, and so it was kind of like that for a while, and I couldn't wait till that cycle ended, but it just, you know, totally just like went to something else, some other horrendous behavior, you know, and meanwhile, you know, I tell you, I love my mom. I loved her so much. She was really sweet. But I kept calling her. And I would call her all the time because outside of driving being fun, getting on that telephone was just like, yes. I could not wait to just drunk dial people. I would dial purposely like Japan, other countries because I wanted to hear them. You know, and saying that I wanted to just hear them from other countries, and I would wind up with a $300 bill every month, my phone bill. This was years ago. It was crazy. Well, you know, I did that for a while. You know, I did that until I got sober. I don't know why I really enjoyed kind of that, but I had my mom just like not understanding the fact that she was so far away. I thought, if she's that far, she can't see me. So how would she know, you know? And I never thought that I was, I always thought I was, sorry, funny, you know, like with her because I could make her laugh, you know, but she didn't tell me or explain to me that I would also get into the pitiful crying stages toward the end of my drinking, you know, when it was just so horrible and I felt that everybody was against me and nobody liked me. Well, because of all my blackouts, I had my daughter to call me, and she had been married. Both my daughters got married just so that they could get away from me. You know, and my one daughter called me and she goes, "Mom, I never want to talk to you again." And I was like, well, what did I do now? I know I walked home a bunch of times drunk from bars and things like that, but I never thought I would do anything to my kid for her to just like, you know, refuse me entrance into her life. And she said, "Well, you invited my husband to your house and told him to leave me home." And the sad part was I couldn't argue with her. I couldn't say, no, I didn't. For one, because I blacked out all the time. And for two, it was like what I did. So that hurt. And then in the same week, you know, I had my other daughter that didn't want to talk to me. My son, his dad had just like totally kidnapped him from me, and that just really enhanced my drinking. I was just like at my peak. I couldn't get drunk enough knowing that my little boy was somewhere that I just didn't know where on this earth. I just couldn't feel that kind of pain. You know, I knew he was meant to be because I had him. And it wasn't that I didn't try not to, but, you know, I was so hurt, so painful through that process that really just piqued my drinking. And so, you know, what I did one night was, it was on Christmas Day, And this was Christmas of 1992. And I called my mother. And there was my mom, so loving. I always tell everybody how loving my mom. My mom thought that everybody was wonderful. She thought that Charles Manson himself was, he could be such a good person if somebody would just love him. You know, and she just thought everybody could just be all right if they were loved. And my mom told me, she goes, "Sweetheart, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do it anymore." And she hung the phone up on me. And I thought, if she could love Manson, how awful must I be? And I was crushed. And I tried to call her back, and she wouldn't take my calls. And it took 1 week later. I drank through the rest of that week, because even the thought of her rejecting me made me drink. But at that point, Boone's wasn't even working. It totally wasn't working. I had been, you know, I forgot to tell you that when during my Mario Andretti years, when I used to drive a lot, I got like a DUI. And it was 0.33 blood alcohol content. And I was totally acting normal through the whole process of being arrested. And the judge couldn't believe, like, why I could be like that normal and how I could have that much tolerance being as frail as I was. So I had to go to, she gave me 3 cards to sign to get 90 meetings in 90 days. And I had never been to AA. I just, like, never been. I didn't know, you know. I had to actually come to AA to find out that I was an alcoholic. I just thought that I would drink too much, and I just didn't know when to stop. But I didn't know I shouldn't start in the beginning. I just didn't know. So I went to this one AA meeting. I had 90 days to do it, but I wait to the 89th day to go. So I went to the old, you know, like San Clemente Friendship Center when it was just like that real filthy room. I loved that place. I just really loved it. Was home. And I walked in there and I gave them, you know, my court card to sign. And it was signed by the Susan F. So Susan F. was, you know, the secretary of the meeting. And, you know, after the meeting, I took my one card with my one signature, and I went home and thought, like, how am I going to get 89 more? And I got to go to court, you know, like, and take them the day after my 90th day. So I sat there and got drunk and consciously, no, I don't think it was consciously, right? But I sat there, I made a decision to forge all these signatures. So I wrote Susan F. the other 89 times for every day. Like, she was the secretary every day. Okay? Every day. She was the secretary. I didn't know how it went, you know, and so I took that 91st day, and he looked so nice, and I forced him so pretty, and so I took him to the courthouse, and everybody was handing in their cards to the clerk, and they were just going. He's like, "Okay, thank you," and he'd stamp them. Well, I gave him mine, and he just like, "I'll be right back." And I hate those words, you know. I mean, I just didn't want to hear that. So he did go, and he came right back, and he goes, "The judge would like to speak to you." And I knew I was in trouble. I was so screwed for that. So what happened was I went in the courtroom, and she said, "So this Susan F. She goes, I want you to bring her back. You have 2 weeks. And you have to produce Susan F. Or, young lady, you're indeed in trouble for forgery. And I was like, okay, you know, as I wet my pants in the courtroom. You know what I mean? It was like, wow, what am I going to do with this? So I came back and I start calling central office. And I went back to that meeting and where Susan, and nobody knew who she was. And I was just frantic, you know, and 2 weeks went by. And all I could do was, you know, go back and just tell her that I didn't have this person. And she told me to put my purse, give my purse to the bailiff because I was in police custody. And I thought that meant they were going to protect me. You know, I thought, oh, police custody, she's so nice. You know, and so, but it's like, why does he want my purse? I can carry my own purse. I didn't even get it. You know, I didn't even get it because I was even drunk at that time. You know, and I couldn't help it. I had to drink. I was compelled to put it in my body and not feel what it took to be just, you know, clear-headed. I couldn't handle it. So, you know, for that penance, I got to go to some more AA meetings for real. But she gave me a choice to take Antabuse. And Antabuse is this disulfiram pill I had to take every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, no matter holiday or whatever. And you would get violently sick if you took it. So I did that. I did it for 18 months, you know, and I really kind of like how it felt not to drink. Didn't stop me from doing my beautiful white powdery substance, though. You know, and because far be it to just be clean, you know, I am truly an alcoholic. And I got finished with that program, and as soon as I was done with it, I was right back at the bar. And I would just totally drink all the booze that this guy had in the bar. He goes, my wine is gone. He called me chicken. It's like, it's gone, chicken. There is no more. And I go, I'll go get some. He'd send me drunk over on a bicycle to go to the grocery store to get some wine just to come back and sell it to me. You know, I had... You know, I was really bad off. I just was. Well, you know, after all was said and done, that program didn't work for me, and I didn't pay any attention to what had happened in AA. But it was, talk about a spiritual experience. It happened for me, like, right away. What happened was on New Year's Eve of 1992, I picked up the phone to call central office. And I told them I just needed somebody to talk to because I was feeling in my head, they're not going to believe you because this is just too horrendous of a story. So they told me they would have a woman to call me back, and she called me back, you know, promptly, and she talked to me. She talked to me through the night, and she took my mind off of what I was still conscious of, wanting to go and get more booze. But at this point, I was drinking 100-proof Stolies, and I wasn't drunk, and I wasn't sober either. I was in a really super bad place, and I just couldn't take it anymore. So she gave me her number, and she goes, if you'd like to go to a meeting tomorrow, I'll be glad to come and pick you up. And so I, you know, the next day, I did my best to just go to bed, and I think that's like maybe the first night that I didn't pass out, because I didn't know how to go to sleep. I did this for 20 years. I passed out every night, and I came to every morning, except for those 18 months that I didn't drink. But I got up the next day and I looked over at a phone number right away. And I thought, did I drunk dial again? You know, but this is local. I guess that wouldn't have been any fun. But, you know, as soon as I saw it and I was, you know, kind of conscious, the phone rang and it was this woman. You know, and she goes, "Hi, how do you feel?" And all of a sudden, I remember what I said I would do. It's like, I don't really want to do this. You know, I kind of really wanted to last night. But so she came to pick me up. And we went somewhere on Crown Valley to a meeting. And this is January 1st. And we got to this one building, and we walked up to it, but there was nobody in it. It was all locked. So I was thinking, you know, it's like, you know, I get to go home, maybe kick back a little bit more, do some more, you know, and she goes, "Oh, no, no, let me just call my husband, and he'll find another place for us to go." And I was really bummed, but you know what, it was like probably at that second, I decided, I may as well just do this, I may as well just do it. You know, this is a kind of a big opportunity. And right at this second, I'm not craving booze. So I think I'm just going to go for it. And so we did find another one. It was just not very far away. And when I got in and we sat in a circle, and it was a woman's meeting, and I just remember how extremely beautiful these women seemed to me. You know, they were clear-eyed, they smelled nice, they were wearing all their Christmas bling, and it was, you know, Mission Viejo. So, you know, but I just saw something totally different that I'd ever seen before. I'd never been in a group of women that were all sober and making sense. And it's like, you know what? I want what they have. I don't know what it is, but I want that. And, you know, that was January 1st, 1993. And I have not had to relapse. I haven't had to take a drink, you know, from that day. And I, the same woman that talked to me on the telephone, she goes, "I can be your temporary sponsor. We'll start working the steps," but she was going to be moving to Las Vegas. And so after she started working the steps with me, and I dove into those steps for as, you know, fearless as I could. I did them, you know, to the best of my ability. But you know what? It was a little difficult for me to, like, do the fourth step, because I would rather blame than to feel guilty. And I had to overcome that, you know. And they talked about God so much. You know, when we read the steps, it was God this, God that. You know, happy birthday to the birthday. I don't know where she went. Oh, but I, you know, what speaks to me is chapter 5. You know, and how it works. And I just saw, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed her path. And so I just start taking these things to heart. My ears, my eyes were open, and I started getting clear-headed and clear-minded after 20 years of being in a fog. I mean, I was really grateful to have this new place in my life. So we worked the steps, and I did them well, except when she moved away, I got a big resentment, you know. And I didn't understand about having resentments, and I felt like she abandoned me, you know, and when she left. But I had to see a therapist because, you know, my neurological levels are just, like, not the best. They're not up there where they should be. And this psychiatrist was talking to me. She goes, I want you to just always remember this one thing. You can only abandon children. Adults just leave. And I was, wow. It was profound. And I heard her. And I got it. And I understood. But I still kept coming back to these meetings. And she told me, she goes, you know what you do? She goes, you go to a speaker meeting. You go to women's meetings. You go to one mixed meeting. You go to step studies. And you incorporate all of that in your life every day. And you'll be okay. Just don't take a drink one day at a time. And I took her solution, you know, and I did. And so every meeting that I went to without a sponsor after that, I would sit there and magically Lorraine would appear. And I know a lot of you don't know Lorraine, but Lorraine and Larry are the most ginormous icons of this program around San Clemente. And we just lost Larry not too long ago with 45 years of the most beautiful sobriety of a person that I'd ever met. We all loved him. Not one person had a bad thing to say about this guy. And between him and his wife, I felt they were just like a tag team on me. When one would, you know, like totally take me closely, the other one would be right there while the other one took a break. And I had them in my life. They became very good friends of mine. And I accepted, you know, her to just be, you know, my friend. And I learned how to have a friendship. I learned how not to blame. I learned to give her the gut level honest truth, you know, in my life. And that's what a sponsor's for. And that's what, you know, that's what she did for me. And, you know, the rest has just been an uphill climb for me. I have been so grateful in my sobriety and in this program, what the steps and the traditions have done for me and what you guys do by just showing up and being there, because we do need each other. We need this fellowship. You know, I've traveled. I remember having, you know, I'd been on home arrest even before, and I had this stupid ankle monitor on, and I remembered throwing a bottle of booze between my legs, getting in my car that I shouldn't have been in, and driving to Oceanside to show my friend my home arrest bracelet. She was freaked out, man. She told me, get out of here, oh my God! You know, you should have this, like, it's not, you know, like a low jack thing. It's, you know, it's okay. But, you know, I mean, I came from a place like that, you know, and I came to this total beautiful, wonderful life that I live, and I have found such a beautiful relationship with me, and I call my higher power God, and it's just been a magnificent journey from the time I couldn't even leave my house at all to being able to fly to different countries. I have gone to AA meetings in Israel, in Italy, in Germany, in Jamaica, in Cuba. I have been around, and I love traveling. That's my new. I get my freak on when I get to get out of here, I'm telling you. But it's so wonderful to have a passport and to be able to. I still, you know, and I'm 19 years sober, and I still smile with so much joy every time I hand it to somebody. It's like I can legally leave, you know, and I can legally come back. And I'm doing the right things today, and my life has just changed, I mean, enormously. And, you know, for somebody that didn't have anything to say, I can talk my ass off. But you know what? I just wanted to share with you tonight what it's like to come from a place of devastation and just the low where you just hate yourself kind of, you know, being a drunk, to a place of, I love myself now. I think I'm some good. I do mission trips. I've been in Russia, you know, to help little children. I've been to Africa to hold little kids, you know, that had AIDS, and just, you know, and I take gifts around the world to different people, you know, and it's just fantastic. My life is full. It's just totally full. And, you know, if God just, you know, allows me, I'll be celebrating 20 years of sobriety on January 1st. And I want to have this big freaking blowout ball dance formal and celebrate. And I want everybody in the world to come. I really do. Because I have never been so joyous in my entire life. And I'm just going to leave you with this because I'm always reminded of this, like, daily. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thanks for letting me share.